Chief Constable, good morning.
Well, good morning.
Good morning, good morning. And welcome to the biggest show in the country.
Well, thank you for letting me have that time on the biggest show in the country.
And you've only come in to us last two. What, have you not been have you not been thinking about me every day? Have you not been listening to the programme?
Well, they say save the best to last, so maybe that's what we should do today, Stephen.
And what do you make of Northern Ireland?
Well, I've come here with open eyes, and you know, I really love it. I've been all over the country, both professionally and in my own time. And if anything, I think the place undersells itself. I think it's some beautiful countryside. I've been made to feel very welcome, both at work and in places I've been and people I've met, and I really enjoy it.
How does it differ from across the water? What do you like about this place?
I like it. It reminds me, frankly, of my time when I worked in Merseyside. I had 25 years working in different jobs in that part of the Northwest. And I think the way people deal with each other, they say it how it is. I think there's a lot of similarities, probably frankly because of history. But I'd rather be open with people and candid, and probably that's why we're here today. But I think there's a lot of optimism for the future, despite some of the short-term issues we talk about. And I think the PSNI is a great organisation, and I'm really proud to lead it.
Well, let's hope that you are open and candid with the public today, because I've a lot to ask you about. And I was interested, can we start in Brexit? Because I can't get away from Brexit. Every day of the week we're talking about it. And you have essentially said that you will, if there were to be border checkpoints or customs checkpoints of any description, you would not police them. Mm. How would you, if there were a security threat at a border checkpoint, how could the police service of Northern Ireland be saying we're not going near them?
Well, we're not policing them. Yeah, that's a great start. And I think they're two separate issues for me, because what I was trying to deal with and actually took legal advice on was the image you might have in somebody's mind that at any particular crossing, you'd have PSNI officers staffing a checkpoint, waving people over and checking passports or goods, because that was some of the narrative that was kicking around the background. So that's naturally not law for us to do that. There will be occasions on a case-by-case basis that we need to protect other agencies that are carrying out checks, and we do that already. And you'll see those checks going on right across Northern Ireland. So it's about being ready for Brexit and actually operating within the law and the duties and responsibilities that we're paid to do.
But would there be a constant police presence at those checkpoints? Because they would be a security threat, wouldn't they?
Well, again, I think we've got to take that on a case-by-case basis. There's no detail yet about how and where those points are going to be established. The latest is really what you've been putting out on the news about some sort of customs centres somewhere near the border. If they're built, you can imagine they'd be protected by things like CCTV and things to look at the environment in which they're in. And we've got to adapt what we do in terms of our presence and our policing style once we get a bit more detail. But the key bit was about not seeing us undermining normality, because I've had the chance to visit the border area myself. I had a number of conversations with the Commissioner Drew Harris and his team. And if there's one message I took out from all of those meetings, it's about the clamour for normality from those communities. Don't affect our day-to-day life. Don't affect the ability to hop between the two sides of a line that sometimes you can't even see in the road.
But there must have been a lot of thinking around those customs centres. We would hope there would have been thinking at a senior level within the PSNI. Do you not think they would be a target for a dissident threat, for example?
Well, yeah, absolutely. Clearly, we've planned for...
So you do think they'd be a target?
Well, we've planned for a whole range of different scenarios. We've got our senior officers in charge of all our Brexit preparations, and you can imagine different things will be at the forefront of our thinking. And clearly, anything, if I can use the language like this, that looks like the state exercising control in that community could be at the risk of attack. And at the end of the day, if these things are built, we've got to work with the people doing that to make sure they're protected as well as they can be.
And you mentioned, Chief Constable, CCTV cameras being part of that. Would we not expect and need an armed policing operation at those customs centres on a persistent, constant basis?
I think, frankly,
how could you leave them unpoliced?
Well, at the moment, we haven't got the detail about how they're going to work and what the actual threat is. There may be occasions where we have armed officers there, and we've got the capability and the preparedness to do that. But at the moment, there's no list of these are going to be 10 custom centres in these towns or areas near the border. When we get that detail, we'll review it with the other agencies that we work with and adjust what we have to do in terms of our policing approach to help us do that.
Because we're not that far away from, potentially, from Brexit. We're not that far. We're only weeks away.
We are.
So the fact that you haven't been briefed by the government as to what these custom centres may or may not look like, is that not concerning? How could you be ready?
Well, at the end of the day, at the moment, I don't think anyone knows the detail of where these centres are going to be, because we'd probably all notice them being built overnight if there had been. And I think we're in that space where Brexit, whatever your views are, seems to be really fast-paced and dynamic. My job here isn't to interfere with what the government's doing in terms of its own preparedness and negotiations. We're just here to give advice about the security context for policing Northern Ireland and respond to what effectively becomes the outcome. And I think it feels a bit last minute, I get that. But at the end of the day, we have to deal with reality.
Because a new armed support unit in the Republic for policing the border region has started operations in counties Cavan and Monaghan. The Irish broadcaster RTE obviously has reported this new unit is to be based in Cavan and will complement two other border-based armed units in Dundalk and Donegal.
Mm.
So they're having armed response units.
Well, I think in a
armed
nice
support
way.
Support unit.
Yeah, we're comparing it apples and pears because of the way we go about policing between the two countries effectively. We have armed officers available all the time. We also have specialist teams that have more armed capability than the people you'll see policing the streets of Belfast or Derry, Londonderry, etc. So it's about dealing with the threat that's in front of us at the time it presents itself. But I'm conscious not to get drawn into blanket promises, and I think it's important that we deal with things on a case-by-case basis at the moment.
How much of a security threat do you think Brexit would present for Northern Ireland?
I think that's, again, it's one of the million-dollar questions, isn't it? Because
But you must have an assessment, and you must be planning for it.
I'm going to tell you what the assessment is.
Welcome to the Knowledge Show.
But I mean, it's a serious matter, isn't it? But broadly, the assessment goes two ways. That you can anticipate over time a change in attacks from dissident Republicans, depending on how Brexit plays out. You can also see there could be some backlash from loyalist communities if jobs and agriculture is put at risk. But at the moment, our assessment, that's about a slow time change. And we'll work closely with the Republic and other agencies to keep an eye on things, as you'd expect us to do, and adjust how we police Northern Ireland to respect that changing threat.
Let me just go into a little bit more. So what is your current assessment? Are you prepared to share with the public? And let's take both the areas you touched upon there. In terms of the dissident threat, if there were to be customs checks or anything like it,
yeah,
what's your assessment of what the dissidents may or may not do?
Well, the assessment, to be candid, is that it hasn't changed over the last decade. We face a severe threat from dissident Republicans to attack, particularly PSNI officers, and we don't see that changing. I sit here today with no intelligence in front of me to suggest that there's any change in the tempo of attack planning against either PSNI officers or other emblems of what they would see as the British state. But clearly we work really closely with communities and other agencies to keep one step ahead of these people that want to do us serious harm and commit heinous crimes.
You talked about loyalist communities. What are you saying?
Well, clearly you understand that from the other side of the argument, people are worried about jobs, agricultural trade, and that there is a risk, depending, because at the end of the day, there's only one offer on the table at the moment, depending on how Brexit goes, that slower time you might anticipate some protests from loyalist communities. But at the moment, there is no emotion there that we're picking up, no change in community relations, but we've got to keep our eyes open.
Do you think if there were to be the so-called border down the Irish Sea, do you get a sense that that could create violence in Northern Ireland?
We don't get a sense it will create any short-term change. I think you've got to look at the economic impact over time. If you can see a world where people lose livelihoods, that finances available to families changes, will that result in a rise in sentiment? Maybe a continuum where you can see sort of peaceful protest, perhaps then accelerating to something else. But that's more scenario planning than predicting the future.
I was thinking more about what about a line where loyalists feel that they're losing their identity and we're stepping towards United Ireland?
Well, clearly, my understanding, and I'm here, it's 100 days today since I've been in Northern Ireland doing this job. So I think it's one of the things I've taken from this job is about respecting how important identity is. And that plays a number of different ways. And that the fact on many of the things that seem to cause trouble in this society, it's about winners and losers. And we have to sort of look at that issue from that lens and see how people perceive changes. Whether we drift towards a clamour for United Ireland, frankly, is a political matter, and I'm not here to get involved in politics.
But you're British, right?
Yes.
Are you proud to be British?
I'm proud to be from the United Kingdom, but I've also got Irish heritage. So that was one of the reasons it felt right to do this. I can't tell you exactly where from. Years ago, I tried to, with my dad when he was alive, research my family tree, and unfortunately it drew a blank, but clearly with a name like Byrne, somewhere in this whole island of Ireland, as my predecessors.
It's been a baptism of fire, as it often is for new people coming into Northern Ireland, and you've got to understand the nuances of any new place. You come into a new job, and it's high risk here because it's high tempo, and if you get something wrong, then there's a lot of noise around it. And one of the things that you got wrong, because you've apologised, is your comments around removing the children of paramilitaries. And what you said at the time is, my message to them, and this is paramilitaries, if you carry on doing this, we will have your house, we will have your car, we will have your kids, we will have your benefits, and we will put you in jail. Why did you apologise for saying you would take away the children of paramilitaries? Why was that the wrong thing to say?
Well, I didn't technically apologise. I sort of reflected on my comments because, as I've said a number of times, frankly, in various settings, you can't put something back in the box once you've said it. So people might accuse me of this sort of almost like a fake apology, if I can see it like that. But what it did teach me, because there was a backlash to those comments from certain communities, that it was an emotive issue. I clearly pricked a raw nerve, and it took me really into some reflection and learning about the effect of civil rights going over decades, not just here we are in 2019, images around internment and what the British state was seen to have done. If a good came out of it, it helped me quickly delve into parts of the community to listen to their emotion and their advice, and I can see how it would have been interpreted in a certain way. That said, it doesn't undermine the fact that one of my priorities as the Chief Constable is to do more to tackle paramilitary crime and the sort of evil power that people exert in communities.
But you've answered that question predominantly by talking about the past.
Yeah.
Will you take or seek to take children away from paramilitaries, gangsters who are currently involved in illegal paramilitary activity? Why wouldn't you want to play your partnership in doing that?
Well, we have actually responsibilities which we carry out at the moment in terms of safeguarding children. So, for example, as I explained at the time, you can imagine the situation where we raid a home. There are drugs and paraphernalia in a home. The home's untidy, it's unkept, there's young children there. We have some questions to ask in that home at the time about whether we have to take children into care in those sort of situations, or, in fact, refer those children to social services. We did it before I made those comments, and we do it since. So I think it's about what I was trying to talk about, clumsily or otherwise, was reminding us that, quite rightly, as you say, we do work in a partnership with other organisations, and that we have safeguarding responsibilities, as do they, when we face certain circumstances. But it's not a blanket policy of... I think I was accused of being a child catcher, Stephen, wasn't I, that we're going to go with a list of people round estates in Belfast and other places rounding up children. That's just completely taking things out of proportion and a misnomer.
But when you say that you didn't apologise, so do you stand over your message? Because some people in Northern Ireland might have admired you for it. Do you stand over your message? That your message to the paramilitaries is, if you do this, we will have your kids?
Well, what I stand over is the fact that we have a range of powers and tactics that we can use from time to time. So, for example, if you're tackling some of the, we know has unexplained wealth, can we go for civil orders to attack that wealth and take it from you? If you're driving an uninsured car or a car that's been obtained illegally, because that's part of the MO of some of these people, we should pursue that as well as criminal justice interventions.
But do you still stand over the message, we will have your kids?
I don't think it's as blunt as that, frankly.
Why not?
Because it's illegal, in a sense, because you can't make a blanket policy just to say, if you, you know, if you're from a certain background, peddling a certain type of crime, we're automatically going to take your children.
Because you can't automatically have your car. You can't automatically have their assets. You've got to go through proper procedure.
Yeah.
I'm trying to understand if you're rolling back or you're standing over the stark message to paramilitaries who hurt other children and peddle drugs to other children and extort money from the families of children and all the stuff that we know about. Do you stand over that you will play a part in trying to remove children from the homes of paramilitaries, if the law allows you to do so?
I think if the law allows us to do so, and if the circumstances that we face when we go into a home show us unequivocally there's a risk to the safeguarding and well-being of a child in that home, we've got a duty to do that. So in that sense, yes, but I think it's to be careful, and absolutely careful, not to confuse specific situations with specific responsibilities and due process with a blanket policy, because that, I think, was where a soundbite got ahead of me.
Was it, just final question on that, would it be a threat? It's illegal to be a member of a paramilitary organisation. Mm. Would it be a threat to a child's safety, in your view, if they were in the home of a paramilitary? Because they're a criminal.
Well, you could apply that to all sorts of different circumstances, because a child might be a threat in terms of well-being in the home of a drug dealer or somebody that commits domestic abuse. So I think it's about looking at it on a case-by-case basis and the circumstances which officers find themselves.
Let's stay on paramilitaries for a second, because there is still extortion going on in Northern Ireland. There is still racketeering. People on the likes of the Shankill Road, for example, are still paying protection money to this day, and your force hasn't been able to stop it.
Well, I think it's one of the big questions that are on people's lips, isn't it? That how small numbers of people exert power, influence, control, and, as you say, punish, inverted commas, people in their community for drug dealing and antisocial behaviour to show some form of perverted legitimacy. We can't tolerate that, and I think it's one of the key issues for the PSNI to get ahead of. It's one of the reasons why I'm calling for more police officers, because I think clearly, unequivocally, having more police officers in communities to give people the confidence to come form us and tell us about who is peddling drugs, causing harm, extorting, etc., etc., is one of the ways that slowly will turn around this evil, heinous behaviour.
Yeah, but is that your big idea? Is that your big, fresh idea? More police officers? It's a lot more complex than that in this country. These people have had a grip on communities for years. What are you going to do about it? What's the new thinking?
Well, firstly, the new thinking is actually to go back to basics and to increase the number of people you'll see on the beat, because my experience of policing a lot of urban areas, for example, Manchester, parts of London, parts of Liverpool, where you get problems with organised crime and some of the similar sort of effects of power and control that people on the beat, being seen, being familiar, being trusted, brings you information about where contraband, drugs, firearms are being held. The second bit is looking at, for example, what the Paramilitary Crime Task Force does. I've got a review going at the moment with other experts from the UK to see, are we using all the powers and tactics that we could to stay one step ahead of these people and to do more to dismantle not just the Mr. Biggs, as it were, but the people that are part of these criminal gangs that, frankly, terrorise some communities in small parts.
But you're still not telling me what you're going to do about it, because police officers on the beat, you know, if you're in one of these communities and someone's coming every week and extorting money out of you, if you don't pay up, you'll get burnt out.
Yep.
Now, a nice friendly conversation with a local officer on the beat's going to do diddly squat about that. You're going to get burnt out that week if you don't hand over the money. These yep. people have an enormous amount of power.
And it's about actually undermining that power slowly. It's about undermining the legitimacy by using all the sort of both criminal and civil powers that are available to my officers, which is why I went back to those early comments, because that was talking about being audacious in terms of how we use legislation to tackle people that think they're beyond the law and they're not.
The former chief constable, it was George Hamilton at the time, said he believed, because I want to stay on the theme of paramilitaries, he said he believed that the, in 2015 this was, George Hamilton said he believed the provisional IRA still exists. Do you?
I've got no evidence to suggest that myself, but
well, whatever. Have you asked?
I haven't asked, because I don't think it's relevant for the short-term issue that I'm dealing with. If someone wants to come and tell me that that dynamic has changed, we'll respond to it. But I've got to deal with the facts before me rather than speculate.
So one of the most notorious organisations in Northern Ireland, you don't know whether it still has an infrastructure. You don't know if the IRA currently exists.
Well, not in the terms of the past. I think what we've got to
no,
look
at... No, in terms
at...
of the present, now. So well, George Hamilton answered it in 2015 and said he thinks the IRA Army Council still exists. The IRA as a structure still exists.
Yep.
And you've come in and got briefed and you don't know?
No, I've come in and got briefed and I've not been told that the structure that George might have told about. I don't know what he said in 2015, but I've got no evidence at the moment to suggest that that council exists.
Have you asked?
I've asked for a brief on all of the sort of threats, and I get regular briefs, frankly, from all of the threats that might face society in Northern Ireland from a range of different backgrounds in terms of which potential terrorist group is operating, is showing influence both sides of the border as we currently see things. And that conversation hasn't led me down a route to believe that the provisional IRA exists in the terms that you're talking about.
So I just want to ask one more question around that. So are you saying you don't know, or are you saying the IRA, it is your view that the IRA does not exist, is not active?
My view is the latter. It's not that I don't know. I mean, I don't know what I can't know in that Domus Rumsfeld speech, as it were.
So you have asked?
Yeah, I've asked a range of questions about, and I have regular briefings from a range of different agencies, including specialists within the PSNI, that tell me what the current threat is and who is operating in a way that presents a threat to the safety and security of the society in Northern Ireland.
A prevailing question in Northern Ireland, and it's something that he emphatically denies, is that Gerry Adams was a member of the IRA. Was he?
Again, that's a matter for others to follow the evidence. I haven't been told personally that he's been seen as a member of the IRA. I mean, there's a lot of commentary out there. There's a current documentary that's running about the history of the Troubles in the past.
Exactly.
And there's a whole investigation running into an element of the past by John Boucher, the former Chief Constable of Bedfordshire. Because that investigation is running, it would be premature of me to go down a route that would speculate about who was or wasn't a member of the IRA Council.
So you're watching those documentaries. Gerry Adams, one of the most high-profile people that exists in Northern Ireland, and you haven't asked for a briefing as to whether he was a member of the IRA or not.
I just don't want to go there in terms of an ongoing investigation at the moment, and I think it'd be premature for me to make any announcements on this programme.
And are you investigating whether he was a member of the IRA?
I just think that John Boucher is conducting an independent investigation to a range of issues on behalf of the PSNI, and that's all I want to say at the moment.
And in terms then of the loyalist paramilitary threat, Chief Constable, what's your assessment of the UVF?
Well, clearly it's not an organisation that is in conflict in the sort of the way it might have been in the past, but it's still an organisation that exerts influence in communities, and we need to do all we can to make sure that the legitimate power and control in communities is the PSNI and nobody else.
So it's not an organisation that's in conflict. Did they not threaten your officers at Avonale Bonfire? Is that not why you withdrew at the time? That sounds like conflict to me.
I'm in conflict in the terms of terrorism. In terms of the Avonale Bonfire, that was an operation that went across, I think it was my second week in the job. It was an operation that ran across a number of days. It wasn't about the UVF exerting threats directly to officers. It was about a whole range of intelligence that we had at the time that really told me that sort of 2 weeks or so before the Open, did we want to get played, inverted commas, and drawn into a conflict, frankly, about taking down a whole load of pallets, which really should have been dealt with earlier than the situation we were facing.
And was part of that assessment of withdrawing, was part of that assessment because the UVF were going to cause trouble?
I don't think, there was elements from my recollection around the sort of intelligence that was shared with us, that the potential from that community, which included the UVS but wasn't specific just to them, there was a lot of emotion about the sort of sentiment about what that bonfire represented. And had we gone in heavy-handed, we could have foreseen conflict. And it was about trying to see the bigger picture in relation to one incident that could have led to copycat violence right across Northern Ireland. And I didn't think it justified... The means didn't justify the ends, if you could see it like that.
So you don't think the UVF is involved currently in terrorism, but it is active. In what way?
Well, it's still, it's an organisation that can be linked to organised crime. It can be an organisation that exerts power and influence in communities in terms of other behaviour, in terms of paramilitary-style attacks that you'd see is just no place in the modern society.
That is terrorism, is it not?
Well, I think we're probably splitting hairs here about what we see.
Yeah.
As terrorism would be defined normally as things that attack on the state. This paramilitary crime is about attacks on individuals and the way of life. And I think...
Do they have guns?
I think there's always the potential for any number of criminal gangs to have access to firearms.
Well, of course there is, but I'm trying to get an assessment from you as to, do you think this is an organisation which has held on to weaponry? Do you think they have many guns, the UVF, the loyalist paramilitaries? And this in the context of there are some people wondering, what is going to happen in Northern Ireland if tensions continue to rise? And that's the relevance of my question.
Yeah, I can understand that. And again, I don't want to get drawn into sort of details of the sort of intelligence picture that goes beyond generalities. I can sit here this morning thinking that in terms of reassuring the listeners, I've got no intelligence to suggest there's huge caches of weapons hidden across Northern Ireland that are available to either side of the terrorist sort of past.
I asked you about Gerry Adams, another person who is quite prominent on the Nolan Show is Jimmy Bryson. Mm. I asked him recently if he's a member of the UVF. Is he? He denied it. Is he? He seems to be quite close to their thinking.
I don't know if he's a member of the UVF myself. I've not met him. I know he's quite quite a strong presence on social media. I think I can't really say much more than that.
So you read his tweets, and you'll have read his tweets then that there have been talking recently about a tension within the loyalist community and people need to be careful.
Personally, I don't follow him on social media, so if that's what he's saying, you'll have to tell me. Clearly, he's somebody that can whip up sentiment, like a number of influencers in social media right across to the UK, and we keep an eye on that.
And he would deny, obviously, whipping up sentiment, wouldn't he? So in terms then, if we just leave the paramilitary issue with this last question, what is your message to the paramilitaries of Northern Ireland as the new man at the top of the PSNI?
That we're coming. That at the end of the day, I will use every power that's available to me in my offices, both within the criminal and civil law, to dismantle your networks and put you in jail if you prey on communities.
Thank you so far, Chief Constable. We'll pause there.